Words come and go in this and any language. I mean, how many people say they take umbrage at another person's remarks anymore? Think about the nuance that word represents. Umbrage seems to fall short of offense. But people do take offense, and more, at the things that other people say and do. It is often justified, but we will explore the cases in which people overreact or overrespond to the perceived aggressions of others. It's a body of thought many people hesitate to enter. Sarah Shulman plunges right in the book, Conflict is Not Abuse: Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. Sarah Shulman teaches humanities at the City University of New York College of Staten Island, and she writes books, lots of them. She's the author of 17 before this one, both novels and nonfiction works like The Gentrification of the Mind. Sarah Shulman, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you.
Give us an idea of your starting point. What got you going on this book?
Well, I had previously written a book on homophobia in the family. It's called Ties That Bind, Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences. And when I looked at the homophobic family, I saw that the group united around the idea that the queer family member was the problem. But actually, it was the homophobic family that was the problem. It was the negative group relationship. And the accusation that the queer family person was doing something wrong was a false accusation. So that's when I began to notice this structure of people in a supremacist position, falsely positioning themselves as being violated or attacked, when actually it was their negative relationships that were creating the problem.
Interesting. Supremacist position. So it could be male supremacy, race supremacy, any perceived supremacy.
It could be anything. Mm-hmm. In my book, I look specifically at the Israeli war on Gaza and the Israeli state rhetoric of seeing themselves as victimized when actually they're the perpetrators. I look at HIV criminalization laws that highly stigmatize people with HIV and treat them as dangerous when actually they're endangered. And I also look at police violence and how we see white police officers claiming to be threatened or under attack by black men who are simply walking down the street or reading a book.
I want to come back to the original example you gave, because you do write at the outset of the book that you ground your perspective in the queer. Why is that important to say?
Well, I think that for people who are into the world of ideas, we're at the point now where we understand that queer is an experience and a lens through which to look at the world, and that it's a relevant one that other people can relate to and learn from.
How important, when working for rights for anyone, you know, anyone for sexual orientation, for skin color, for anything, when working for rights, to remind the people with whom you are trying to obtain those rights, from whom, in some cases, you're trying to obtain those rights, that you're not abusing them?
Well, it's a smokescreen. I mean, and it exists in the personal as well as in the political and the social. It's where people who are the problem but who have the apparatus of punishment or the apparatus of the state or the family or whatever, they use false accusations or false arguments of victimization as a smokescreen so that they don't have to interrogate their own behavior.
Victimization, it's an interesting concept there, because are we quick, you think, in culture today to adopt either a victim role or say that someone is victimizing us?
Well, if you look at the election, you know, I think it's a very good example. We have President-elect Trump, who every single day is describing himself as a victim, especially when other people tell the truth about him. You know, that he's victimized by the media, he's victimized by Taiwan, everyone is doing something terrible to him, he takes no responsibility. But at the same time, he took a group of people, white working class people in America, who actually are oppressed and are in a disenfranchised state, and manipulated them into blaming the only people who have less power than them, which is immigrants, instead of pointing the finger at the real party, which is the 1% that has globalized their jobs.
All right. So a lot to talk about here, obviously. Did you hesitate at all to get into this area, I wonder?
No, it was necessary. The book that I wrote before this was called Israel, Palestine, and the Queer International, and that's when I started to examine the Israeli state rhetoric. And it was just so clear that increasingly people with real power, whether it's in the intimate realm or the geopolitical realm, use this language of victimization as a smokescreen for their own complicity.
All right, so it really is the people who are possessing of great power who act like the put-upons.
Yes, or they manipulate people who really are in a traumatized position to blame the wrong party.
So it seems like what you're talking about here is really a kind of a preventive view. You're trying to get things resolved at a conflict stage before people get a chance to claim victimization or anything else for that matter.
Well, what I'm trying to say is on the intimate level, let's put it that way, you know, it's very, very common now. Let me just give some terms. I use the word abuse to mean power over, and conflict is power struggle. Obviously, there is real abuse that's pervasive in our society, not just intimate relationship abuse, but abuse of children and political abuse that individuals receive in very damaging ways. But there's also this other category of conflict, which is power struggle, where two parties are participating in creating a problem. The reason that people escalate the charges and overstate harm and portray themselves as not participating in conflict, but instead as being victimized, is because in our culture right now, in order to be eligible for compassion, you have to be purely victimized or purely innocent. We're always looking to see who to punish instead of trying to understand exactly what's happening.
So potentially more compassion for the people we would otherwise punish?
Well, I don't think that punishment works. And we're all very oriented right now towards calling the police, calling in the state, calling the authorities, figuring out who should be punished. But actually, if our focus was to try to understand what happened, we might have a lot more resolution and a lot less escalation.
All right. Much more to talk about with Sarah Shulman. Her book is Conflict Is Not Abuse. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange, and we can take your phone calls and emails as well in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sarah Shulman, a humanities professor at City University of New York, College of Staten Island. She is a prolific writer and has written a book that is bound to be provocative. It gets people to think really hard about the ways in which we portray disagreements with other people, other bodies of people, other nations, you name it. The book is called Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So at the outset of the book, Sarah, there's three major areas you identify. People punished for doing nothing.
Right. My example is Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, who was killed for walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at people who are punished for normative conflict. My example is Janae Rice, the wife of Ray Rice, the Baltimore Ravens running back. And I think we all remember in the summer of 2014, we saw video footage of him punching her unconscious in an elevator and dragging her out by her heels. You know, everybody has conflict with your partner. It's unavoidable. But for some people, they receive it as such a high violation that they respond with violence. So nothing, normative conflict, and resistance. And my example there is the Israeli war in Gaza in 2014, where when Gazans resist the Israeli siege, which has been in place since 2005, Israel describes that as an attack, as them endangering them, as Israel being threatened, when actually it's resistance against unjustified treatment.
Are you leaving out a few things, though, like the rocket attacks into Israel?
Well, the original rocket attack was a response to an escalation by the government, and those rockets are really just symbolic. I mean, they're barely functional. They certainly don't justify 2,000 civilians being murdered by aerial bombing.
So it seems like the way you portray it, the paradigm that we tend to stick to is perpetrator and victim, and that needs to transition to something else. Do you have a good idea of what the something else should be?
Well, I think obviously in cases of abuse, there are perpetrators and victims. But in cases of conflict, I think we should just understand each other as the conflicted. And, you know, right now, our definition of loyalty is that we help our friends hurt people. You know, somebody breaks up with someone, so then we're cruel to the person they broke up with. But what if our definition of loyalty was that we help people negotiate, that we supported people in taking responsibility or asking tough questions? Then I think, you know, it would be considered normal for people in conflict to have help negotiating.
That's a really difficult thing to get across, I would think, in this time, particularly when it's not just that we want to hurt the people who've hurt the people we love, but, I mean, we hardly even ever talk to the people on whatever we perceive the other side is. I mean, you talked about this election, and that's a lot of it. I mean, the fact that half the country is wondering who the hell the other half is.
Well, I mean, there's the problem in the personal realm anyway. I mean, I'm amazed at how many times a day I'm asked to hurt somebody. You know, they're like, don't invite her. Don't go to that party. Why are you working with them? We're constantly being asked to shun people. But when I'm asked to shun someone, I immediately call that person and ask them what they think is going on. Because we're often being cruel to people without ever having spoken to them or understanding how they see the events.
So let's stick on the personal level, because we were talking about Janae and Ray Rice and that whole situation, and you do get fairly deeply into cases of domestic abuse. Mm-hmm. How do you see them being handled now that is not helpful?
Well, now we're in a paradox where, first of all, many women who are abused are not listened to, and nobody believes what's happening to them, and they don't have the support that they need. On the other hand, I conducted an interview with Catherine Hodes, who is a social worker in New York City, and she found that increasingly women were coming in using the word abuse to describe something else. So when she started to ask them what the order of events were and to describe the situation, she realized that they were frustrated by being in situations that they didn't know how to resolve and facing problems that they didn't know how to handle, and that those situations were devastating and tormenting and painful, but they do not mean that a person is being abused. That we can be suffering and feel terrible, but it doesn't mean that the person in front of us is necessarily the cause of our pain. And that's something we have to separate out. Now, because conditions for women were so terrible in the recent past, a lot of social service providers are over-anxious to find that somebody is being abused, at the same time that other people who are being abused are not being validated. These two things are existing simultaneously. But she found that a lot of social service workers come in trying to find out who is the perpetrator so that they can be punished. And this backfires constantly. When I review the materials on national anti-gay violence hotlines around the country, I found shockingly that in 2013, half of all domestic violence cases where the police intervened in same-sex couples, they arrested the perpetrator instead of the victim in over half the cases. Because when the people were the same gender, they couldn't tell who the perpetrator was, so they arrested the person who was butch or brown or not a mother or HIV positive or undocumented. So other prejudices intervened. And so the system doesn't work in that regard. And it's because, you know, if we had the kind of social relationships that helped us negotiate conflict, we wouldn't be turning to the state and turning to the police as arbiters of conflict. That's an inappropriate role for them. And by the way, the police in America are the profession with the highest rate of domestic violence of any profession, including NFL players. So they're the last people we should be turning to solve interpersonal problems that are not violent.
Sarah Shulman is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. It seems like you've probably tested the thesis of your own book just by writing it. I mean, I have to believe you've taken a fair amount of flack from people about this.
Actually, no.
Really?
Well, I mean, online I have, but not in person. Mm-hmm. I've been on a book tour. I've been to 10 cities now, and in almost every city I've had packed rooms, 100 people, 150, 200 people standing, long conversations that were very sincere and very diverse audiences, because, you know, people are on the political level, they're stunned by the amount of scapegoating and racism and blame that's come out of the Trump campaign. And on the personal level, they're fed up with these what's called call-out culture, people being taken down for minor slights, the expectation that none of us should ever have to be uncomfortable. I mean, people are understanding that it's not working. It's not working intimately, and it's not working sociopolitically.
Do you think we would have been like this? I mean, it's hard to separate them, obviously, but do you think we were like this anyway, or that the internet and the ability to flame people anonymously, for example, exacerbates the situation?
I don't think it originated in the internet. I think that, you know, in the 1960s, there was a feminist movement against violence, and they saw male violence against women and children as caused by patriarchy, poverty, and racism. And these were grassroots movements. But when Reagan was elected in 1980, he eliminated the CETA program, which eliminated funding for these grassroots community services. And all of these anti-violence services became under the purview of the government. Now, this creates a crisis in meaning because the U.S. government is one of the greatest sources of violence in the world. And, of course, these laws would be enforced by the police, which we all understand are very problematic. And interestingly, in the 80s, you start to see popular cultural propaganda for this idea. Television shows like Law and Order, Special Victims Unit emerge in that period. And they depict, you know, the purely innocent victim, the purely evil perpetrator, and the answer is the police. So I think there was a real development of cultural and policy direction in that post-Reagan period, where people were told over and over again that the police are the proper arbiters of personal conflict. And I think that's a lot of why we're here now. And we're always seeing it on television. You know, someone has a fight with their son. They call the police come, they kill their son. You know, we've been, now that we're more aware of police violence, we see this over and over again.
You describe a real inflationary process here. I mean, people feeling assaulted when they're not. I mean, you talked about the 60s here. And so is that really where the inflation started, as you put it?
Well, I think it's when it came out of the hands of the grassroots communities and was put into the hands of the government. But there's also a concept that's evolved recently among a certain class that they have the right to never be uncomfortable, that somehow being uncomfortable is wrong and it's something to be avoided, and that we're entitled to never be uncomfortable, and that if we are uncomfortable, it's an assault. You know, I wrote a book about gentrification. It's called The Gentrification of the Mind. It's about how gentrification changes the way people think. And when you look at the rhetoric of gentrification, you see, like, you'll have a mixed class, mixed race community. And then you have gentrifiers, suburbanized upper class whites, moving into those neighborhoods and saying that the neighborhoods are, quote, dangerous. And then as they gentrify it, as they make people homeless and displace people, they say that the neighborhood is getting better. It's not getting better. They are dangerous. But it's a flip. So with that comes this whole mentality. It's kind of a gentrified mentality of, you know, never having to face difference, never having to be uncomfortable, relying on the police, this type of thing. And, you know, it's operating in the personal and in the social realm.
Sarah Shulman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her quite provocative book is called Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. I should point out there's really two knots here. It's not just that conflict does not equal abuse, but you also point out that harm is not a justification for cruelty. And it seems like in today's world, harm is very broadly defined, isn't it?
Yes, like I think that, you know, there's a certain class of people who feel that they should never have to look at themselves. You know, one of the insights of the book is that supremacist people and traumatized people actually can sometimes share this absolute rejection of opposition or criticism. You know, a person who's raised in a supremacist way, let's look at Donald Trump as the ultimate example, but we all know them. They're raised that they should never have to be questioned, that whatever they want is right, that anything that's in their way is an assault or an attack. And so when you try to be interactive with them, they become very punitive and they use their power to hurt you. But sometimes traumatized people can be in the same boat, because sometimes when when we're traumatized, ourselves are so fragile and it's so hard to keep it all together. That, you know, when somebody is making us have to rethink something about ourselves in a critical way, it can feel overwhelming, as though everything's going to fall apart. And so sometimes that, too, can be seen as an attack or violation. I mean, I have a chapter called Calling the Police on Your Partner When It's Your Father Who Should Have Gone to Jail. You know, we're constantly seeing people who were hurt in their childhood who then take it out on their partner, or people who are hurt in a place that they have no way of responding, who look for the person who's right in front of them, the person who cares the most, and then they blame it all on them, and they act it all out on them. So, you know, this overstating harm is not just a tool of the state, although it enhances the power of the state, but it also occurs in people who don't have that much power. It's something that we see in both the traumatized and the supremacists.
If, in the examples you give, if people have given that much power to the state to be the final arbiter, have they lost the knowledge, the memory, the ability to attempt to find justice among themselves?
I think it has to do with the group relationship. You know, we have this kind of nationalist idea about what loyalty is, you know, America, right or wrong, that sort of thing. And we apply it to our families and to our friends. So many families are based on a concept of the perfection of the family and fear of outsiders, and they unite in projecting blame on outsiders, and certainly racial groups function that way, and religious groups, national groups, but also cliques function that way, and couples, and communities function that way when they have negative bonds. But if a group is a healthy group that has positive bonds, then they help each other. You know, if somebody says, oh, I broke up with my girlfriend, I want you to hurt her. Well, instead of saying, yeah, I'm going to go get her, real friends sit down and say, you know, let's talk this through. How can I help the two of you talk? I understand you're upset. I think you're overreacting. Let's go through the steps and see where you can make a difference. You know, they try to help us keep our relationships together and keep our communities together. I recently participated in a forum in Montreal on suicidality in the queer and trans community, which, as I'm sure you know, is epidemic. And people were talking about how being shunned or kicked out of their cliques or being shunned by the friends of their former partners makes people feel so isolated and desperate. It makes people feel suicidal. Because sometimes people don't have other support systems. And it can be very, very crushing to shun people. I don't see any reason for shunning anyone. I think shunning is an active form of harassment as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, there are people in society who want to have reconciliation on every level. I mean, there are people who want to have reconciliation with someone who murdered their parents. You know, there are people who are looking for reconciliation. But then there are people who will, like, refuse to speak to you for the rest of their lives because they didn't like an email that you wrote. You know, it's very characterological, these kinds of responses. So just because a person responds very extremely and punitively and is completely unable to be self-critical doesn't mean that that position should be reinforced by the people around them.
But what's being enforced there, it sounds like, is group loyalty, that, you know, you're either with me or you're against me.
It's a false loyalty. It's very detrimental. And, you know, we've seen it just in the election where white working class people identified with Trump because they identified by race and not by their class experience or class interests. And this kind of race loyalty or race war mentality was manipulated to bring a person to power who is going to hurt that community. So this kind of blind loyalty is extremely negative for individuals and for society.
Let's take some calls. We have Nicole in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sarah Shulman, the author of Conflict Is Not Abuse.
Oh, good morning to both of you. I really wanted to call in because I completely agree with your perspective. And I just feel it's sort of rare. I don't usually hear people expressing these values like you do and the lack of, and people feel, just as far as people feeling entitled to have what they think they want without actually trying to put themselves in another person's place and be fair about it. So anyway, basically, I just tuned in, so I just heard some of it, but I really appreciate what you're saying.
Thanks, Nicole.
I appreciate that, Nicole. Wow, there's so many different ways to go here. I wanted to come into the person to person things you talk about, because early in the book, you've got a heading called The Dangerous Flirt.
Mm-hmm.
I want to walk this line carefully. What are you saying about people receiving unwanted attentions, claiming that they've been abused?
Well, I don't want to use the word claiming, because some things bother some people that don't bother other people because of their characters, their histories, etc. And so it's very hard to set an objective standard. And we have to listen to each situation and try to take it apart, you know, based on the specifics of the person. But the fact is, if somebody is interested in someone sexually or romantically and the other person isn't interested, it doesn't mean that they can't be friends. It doesn't mean that because someone expressed an appreciation or a desire, that's not inherently a hurt. It might make people uncomfortable because they don't know how to say no. Or it might be because they have also some kind of desire that they can't express for whatever reason. Or there's all kinds of things, reasons that people might be uncomfortable with that, but it's not an attack or an assault. Obviously, if, you know, you're not interested in someone and they are constantly, constantly trying to get you to have sex with them, that is across the line. But people desire each other, and it's a beautiful thing, and we can still be friends.
Much more to talk about with Sarah Schulman. Her book is Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. We'll get into who that duty falls upon. I presume it's all of us. We'll find out in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back and talk more with Sarah and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Sarah Schulman at City University of New York College of Staten Island has written a book that really makes us think about how we approach differences in society, differences in the sense of I have a difference with you on this, how we get from conflict to worse places, ranging from very small interpersonal situations like flirting in the office to very large international situations like how the Israelis and Palestinians interact. Sarah Schulman's book is Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 over the phone. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about situations where people express romantic interest and somebody else doesn't want that romantic interest, that it's not necessarily a harmful thing. But I wonder how much of this gets into care or lack of care with language. And you'd use the phrase, I feel like I've been raped. And honestly, just last night after I read this book, there was a discussion on Facebook about the song Baby, It's Cold Outside, mm-hmm. which some people have taken to calling the rape song. Mm-hmm. And there was a discussion there about maybe we're going too far with identifying things as rape. And so I just wonder where
well,
you
Well, we have, there's a use of language that I don't think is that helpful because rape is a real experience. So to say, like, he was so horrible to me, you know, he was so nasty to me, I felt like I was raped. That's a ridiculous statement because, you know, it's not how you would feel if you were raped. And similarly, you know, people use language like, he's an abuser, he's a harasser, he's a stalker, when that's not actually what's happening. I mean, stalking is a real thing. You know, when your ex-husband is sitting in a car with a gun in front of your house, that's a completely different experience than someone who's trying to straighten out a misunderstanding that a person is refusing to deal with. But, there, you know, so using this sort of language casually is all about escalation. And because if we don't say the truth, we don't say accurately what happened, we don't get the compassion and support that we feel that we need. Similarly, the word violence. In the book, I suggest that we only use the word violence for physical violence. And sometimes emotional, you know, emotional assault or words can be more hurtful than physical violence. That's true. It can be more damaging sometimes. But they're distinctly different experiences. So using words for experiences that they don't match to is part of the whole escalation process.
With that particular example of words, I did find myself wondering about how much the perception of abuse is dependent upon the relationship. I mean, might words used on a spouse be conflict, but used on a child be abuse?
It could be, whether it's power over or power struggle. You know, if two people are participating in escalating a situation, it's conflict.
All right. I did ask before about how much the Internet has gotten into this. You do get into electronics yourself in the book on a different
right.
level about texts and emails and how you think those are part of the problem.
Well, I have a complex view on this. On one hand, the thing that really I find disturbing is when people get angry at a text or an email or a Facebook and then block the person or won't be friends with them anymore. Whereas if they would just pick up the phone and talk to them, they could actually probably work it out. So there's this way that it becomes infantilizing emotionally. It becomes a substitute for the give and take that's required for adults to understand what each other means. On the other hand, in the chapter in the book on the 2014 Israeli war in Gaza, I show the benefits of social media. During that period, I followed everyone in Gaza who Twittered in English. And by showing the Twitter feeds, I'm able to show what people there were actually experiencing and contrast it with the very, very censored U.S. media reporting on the events. And so you get to see this kind of confusion that is created when people's real experiences won't be replicated, and you can only understand them if you're on social media. So there's, of course, enormous advantages to the Internet. It provides all of this alternative access to information. But emotionally, if you having an argument with somebody, especially someone you know, you should speak to them. Because there's nothing like affect, and there's nothing like go back and forthing with another person. If you're texting and you send someone 5 texts, it's considered harassment. It's considered way too much. But it's actually even less than 2 minutes of conversation. You know, so it's really not adequate for problem solving.
And in fact, you cite a situation in the book where someone appeared to be stalking you. How did you deal with that?
No, that's actually, they weren't. But mm-hmm. I was invited to feel that way. I had a male graduate student about 15 years ago who I then discovered had a blog saying that he was in love with me and he wanted to have sex with me and this kind of thing. So I went to my colleagues and I told them about it. And they said, he's stalking you. You should go to the administration. And it was interesting because they were inviting me into a victim identity. And if I went along with their suggestion that I was being stalked, then they would be wrapping their arms around me and, quote, protecting me, and I could be in that kind of cared for feeling. But on the other hand, I was very disturbed that none of them offered to talk to him to find out what he thought was happening or encouraging me to ask him what was happening. And that was so disturbing to me that they were willing to have me punish him and maybe even ruin his career without ever speaking to him, that I called him. I said, look, I'm transferring you to another supervisor. Obviously, I can't continue to be your supervisor because you've made me feel uncomfortable. But it doesn't mean that I don't support your work. And I'm willing to discuss this with you until it's resolved. So I didn't do one of these power trips like, you have 10 minutes and don't ever call me again, one of these games, childish mm-hmm. games that people play. And so we talked twice extensively, and I learned a bunch of things. One thing I learned was that in that era, younger people felt free to discuss feelings on the Internet that people of my generation were not yet used to doing. And so there was a generational difference. And the second thing was that he was from a very oppressed community, and he had never had an authority figure who had treated him with respect before, and that's why his feelings got out of control. So once we breached all of that, you know, there was no reason for there to be tension or anger and certainly no punishment. He went on and worked with somebody else, and now 15 years later, we're friends. So, you know, it's like, you know, you can be invited into victimization with the promise of a reinforcing protection, but it's a dangerous invitation.
Did you get ostracized by the colleagues who wanted you to censure or otherwise?
But I gave up the chance to be, you know, falsely protected from something that wasn't dangerous.
So while we're talking about campus issues, you do get into trigger warnings on campus. Obviously, you teach on campus. What is your approach?
Well, I teach at a working-class school, the City University of New York. And interestingly, I have never been asked for a trigger warning, and none of my colleagues have ever been asked for a trigger warning. Our students are living with a great deal of violence, real violence in their lives that many of them don't even really understand they shouldn't have to live with. So the discussion is really on a completely other level. So my observation is that right now that culture is in more upper middle class or upper class schools and not in working class schools. My general feeling is, you know, the question is, what is a trigger? And for me, a trigger is when we have unresolved pain from the past that is expressed in the present, a present that is not responsible for having caused that pain. And there's two different approaches to this. One is to get the community support to make mistakes and be vulnerable so that we can resolve the pain. Or the other is to go through life trying to control everything in the exterior world so that we never have to be reminded of the unresolved pain. And I think that the second strategy is, first of all, not possible. It's not realistic. But if you're a person from an upper class and you happen to have power, it can be quite dangerous. It can be quite controlling of other people in ways that are not appropriate. So, you know, in general, it's the paradigm of having internal anxieties that we externalize. It's like when a police officer says, oh, that black man had a gun, and then you find out it was a book. You know, he has an internal anxiety of racism, and he externalizes it. He finds places in the world where he claims that his anxiety is being justified, but it's not. And that's very much what being triggered is about. So to give people control over what is going to happen in the classroom based on unresolved past experiences, I don't think it's beneficial to them, and it certainly goes against what the concept of education is, which is the classroom. Certainly, all kinds of oppressions take place in classrooms, but very little actual physical or sexual assault takes place in a classroom. So the classroom is the place where we can engage difficult and sometimes frightening or intimidating ideas. It's the place in our lives that is designed to do that very thing. And so to restrict that, I think, is a mistake.
When you say oppressions take place in a classroom, what do you mean?
Well, like sexism or racism on the part of the professor, or, you know, oppressive values being replicated. That happens in classrooms all the time. But physical assault and violence rarely happens, or I don't know of it ever happening, in the classroom.
On the larger scale, I mean, way outside the classroom here, you describe traumatized behavior and supremacy ideology resembling each other. Can you explain that?
Yes. You know, even though supremacy behavior in one party may create trauma in another, and of course they can both exist in the same body, but what I find that in terms of being unwilling or unable to tolerate opposition, sometimes they're a mirror image of each other. And I think we discussed this a little earlier, that sometimes the supremacists, and let's just look at Donald Trump as the ultimate example, anyone who criticizes him, even with the truth, he claims that somehow they're abusing him, they're victimizing him. He feels completely violated and attacked by being confronted with reality or by other human beings' realities. You know, that's the ultimate supremacist position, but we all know the kind of local big man who's the local celebrity who's a bully and whose partner and whose family members have to run around all the time organizing everything around him so that he never has to be faced with any opposition. He never apologizes. You know, that's a very good indication of a person in that role. And, you know, we're all familiar with that type. They just refuse to be questioned. On the other hand, people who've been really, really violated often have trouble accepting difference or negotiating that other people have needs or that people might be questioning something that they're doing because they feel so endangered that any kind of little form of difference or opposition becomes very, very threatening, way out of proportion to what it really is. And then we see a lot of overreaction in the intimate realm.
There's an email here from Jeff in Ashland who wrote it a few minutes ago. He says, the numbers simply don't lie. The numbers of civilians killed in Gaza or the number of black men arrested and incarcerated in the United States, etc. Thank you for your clarity, he writes. How do we reverse the narrative? That again from Jeff in Ashland.
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Right now, we don't really understand exactly how this is all going to unfold in the new society that we're living in. And history is happening to us right now on the runaway train. So we don't know, you know, what we're going to have to do. But the larger question is to stop punishing people because the system is not working for them and to start trying to understand what is happening. And that's in the most intimate moments and in the, you know, in the geopolitical moments. So it's a big spiritual question, but it's something that we can approach personally. Look, I'm 58 years old, and I've been a lesbian all my life, and I have seen a huge paradigm shift in terms of how gay people experience life. You know, when I first started out and I had decided to be openly gay from the beginning, there's no way that you and I would be having this discussion right now because the point of view that I represented was such a repressed and forbidden point of view. Now I can be a professor, I can publish my books, you and I can discuss these questions with intelligence. And, you know, things have really changed, but they not, you know, it's not finished, but there's been a lot of change. And this type of change happens on all different levels at the same time. So if just personally, the next time your friend asks you to hurt someone that they know, call the person and ask them what they think is going on. Tell your friend that you care about them and you want to help them figure out how they've participated in the problem. Tell them you're willing to help them negotiate. I mean, it's just those little kinds of shifts. And at the same time, we advocate for our larger agenda on all kinds of policy and social levels.
Some of this is already underway. I know schools certainly have restorative justice programs where the people who've been harmed and the people who they perceive as having harmed them get together. And they,
yeah, sometimes those things work and sometimes they don't work. I mean, sometimes those things become kind of vigilante re-victimization things where people are never forgiven for transgressions. They're constantly shunned and they never get to have their voice heard. I mean, those systems, it really depends on where you are and who's doing them.
So the duty of repair belongs to us all. I mean, how what's a good first step for any of us?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people need to speak to each other. You know, they say time heals all wounds, but it's actually not true. Time embeds wounds. And people just need to sit down and speak to each other and tell each other what they've experienced and see if they can move forward.
All right, you've given us a lot to think about. The book is called Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. Sarah Shulman wrote it. Thanks so much for joining us on the
Thank
Exchange
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.